Headlines: Iran's leader says that enemies have been frustrated time and again in encountering the Islamic Republic due to the nation's resistance against the pressure. Top negotiators from Iran and the United States arrived in the Qatari capital for indirect talks on the removal of anti-Tehran sanctions. And 46 people are found dead inside of a truck in Texas in one of the most deadly incidents of human smuggling along the U.S.-Mexico border. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Our first story, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says enemies have been frustrated time and again thanks to the Iranian nation's resistance against the pressure. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei says over the past four decades, enemies have been hoping that certain weaknesses and shortfalls would eventually result in the collapse of the Islamic Republic. Yet the Iranian people have dashed their hopes time and again. According to Ayatollah Khamenei, the Iranian people's resilience, their endeavors, and a refusal to be intimidated are what makes them victorious vis-a-vis the enemies. The leader made the comments in a meeting with judiciary officials and advised them to make the fight against corruption a priority. The top negotiators from Iran and the U.S. arrived in the Qatari capital for indirect talks on the removal of anti-Tehran sanctions in a bid to revive the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. The Iranian Foreign Ministry says the meeting will be within the framework of agreements reached during the recent visit to Tehran by the JCPOA Joint Commission Coordinator, Joseph Borrell. Tehran says that it was informed by Borrell that the U.S. has agreed to fulfill all of its obligations under the JCPOA and ensure Iran's economic benefits. It has urged the U.S. and the three EU parties to the deal to adopt a realistic approach for a deal to be reached. The 2015 accord was left in tatters after the former U.S. administration unilaterally abandoned it in 2018 and reinstated sanctions on Iran. Talks to revive the JCPOA began in the Austrian capital in April of last year between Iran and the remaining signatories to the accord. The U.S. indirectly participated in the Vienna talks, but the talks were stalled in March of this year over what Iran called the U.S. failure to make the necessary decisions. International affairs expert Zamir Ahmad Awan believes that the U.S. is somehow stuck in a kind of paradoxical situation that it has created in its policy towards Iran.
I am not sure, but it seems that Americans are flexible now. They have realized the ground situation. And if they will not satisfy Iran's demand, the deal will not happen. Definitely, on the other hand, they want to keep Iran as a terror or threat to the oil-rich Middle Eastern country to sell their weapons. But on the other hand, they also wanted to reach a deal with Iran. They cannot afford enmity with Iran for indefinite time. They are compelled by the geopolitics that they need more friends, less enemies. And in this background, I believe the Americans have to show some flexibility.
Iran says the fact that the U.S. uses economic means to exert pressure on independent countries clearly violates human rights. The Foreign Ministry says Washington is resorting to economic terrorism to achieve its political goals. The Ministry has released a statement on the occasion of the American Human Rights Review and Exposure Week. The statement says the U.S. unilateral sanctions meant to force governments to change their policies is a clear and systematic violation of human rights. According to the Ministry, sanctions have become a tool in Washington's hands for violating the legitimate rights of the Iranian people. The Ministry has also listed a number of crimes that the U.S. has committed directly and indirectly against the Iranian people. Palestinian movement Hamas making a plea for international action in order to end Israeli violations in the occupied Al-Quds. Hamas says countries and international organizations have a responsibility to put an end to the regime's crimes, illegal settlement activity, and the Judaization of Islamic and Christian holy sites. The resistance movement is urging Muslim nations to support the Palestinian fight for their land and sanctities, especially the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The movement has also warned Israel that Al-Quds remains an inseparable part of Palestine and that all attempts to change the city's identity will fail. Israel occupied Al-Quds 55 years ago in a move never recognized by the international community. Over the past months, the regime has intensified its attacks on worshippers in and around the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Israeli settlers also regularly transgress into the holy Muslim compound. Israeli Knesset is getting closer to its dissolution as lawmakers unanimously passed the first reading of a bill on parliament's dispersal. All 53 members of the outgoing coalition and the opposition parties voted for the bill at a session late last night. The discussions also focused on the timing of the new elections. The final bill will be endorsed on Wednesday. Once it is passed, Prime Minister Naftali Bennett will have to hand over power to the foreign minister. Yair Lapid will then serve as interim prime minister until a new government is formed. Israeli politics has been plagued by instability for several years. The passing of the bill will push the regime towards its fifth election in less than 4 years. The elections will be held sometime between late October and early November. The World Food Program says it is suspending humanitarian aid to Yemen. The international body says that it is halting the shipments due to lack of funding and disruptions in food supplies rooted in the war in Ukraine. Abdul Latif al-Washali has more from Sana'a.
After years of war and blockade on Yemen, and just as hopes were being raised that the humanitarian situation will improve thanks to the UN brokered truce, the World Food Programme has announced that it is suspending humanitarian work in the country since the beginning of June. The body says it is short on funding and that obstacles to food supply due to war in Ukraine are making things worse.
There is no doubt that the decision of the World Food Programme to suspend its activities in Yemen is catastrophic and surprising. The World Food Programme announced earlier this year that it will be cutting off on humanitarian aid for Yemen due to lack of funding. The suspension of humanitarian activities is a totally different story and has major repercussions, as Yemen is facing what the United Nations calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Unfortunately, the UN and its food assistance programme link humanitarian aid to political and military issues.
The program now says that the Yemen humanitarian response plan for 2022 is 74% underfunded, which means the program requires $1.5 billion in funding.
What the media reported that the World Food Program will suspend its activities in Yemen will lead to a humanitarian catastrophe with unimaginable consequences. We hold the United Nations fully responsible for the repercussions of halting humanitarian aid, as Yemen is in a phase of famine.
Saudi Arabia began its war on Yemen in March 2015 and has imposed a siege on the country ever since. The war has killed tens of thousands of civilians and pushed the war-torn country to the brink of famine, where almost 80% of the population depends on humanitarian aid to survive.
After all the hard work put into reaching the current truce and extending it, suspension of humanitarian aid could also undermine the political process. The United Nations should now double its efforts and change its strategies to help Yemenis in dire need of aid. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
A remote area in Texas, an abandoned truck, and stacks of dead bodies. That is a grim picture from one of the deadliest cases of human smuggling along the U.S.-Mexico border. U.S. authorities have found the bodies of 46 undocumented migrants in a semi-trailer near the rail track in San Antonio. 16 people, including four minors, were still alive. They are currently being treated for heat stroke and exhaustion. So far, three people are in police custody. The U.S. border with Mexico has seen an influx of migrants over the past months. Many of them are returned or have been returned under a controversial policy that former President Donald Trump introduced. The incumbent Joe Biden has faced a lot of criticism from fellow Democrats for failing to reverse the restrictions, but Republicans blast his open border policy. A rail travel from Los Angeles to Chicago turns into a nightmare for passengers after the train collides with a truck on its route. Seven of the eight wagons were derailed and toppled on their sides as the long-haul train was crossing through rural Missouri. There have been three deaths and multiple injuries. The train was carrying more than 200 passengers and around a dozen crew. Officials say that the train was crossing a gravel road that had neither lights nor electronic control devices for the tracks. The National Transportation Safety Board says that a 14-member team will investigate the derailment. Just one day before this incident, another train struck a passenger car at a crossing in California, leaving three people dead. Venezuela says it's hosting a U.S. government delegation to discuss a bilateral agenda. President Nicolas Maduro said on national television early this morning that U.S. officials are meeting with the National Assembly Speaker in the continuation of the talks that started in March. The talks mainly focus on some eight U.S. nationals detained in Venezuela, with their charges ranging from embezzlement to terrorism. Two Americans jailed in the Latin American state were freed, following a visit by a team of U.S. officials 3 months ago. Bilateral relations have been sour, with Washington supporting Venezuela's main opposition figure against Maduro's government. The White House has also imposed the toughest of sanctions on Caracas. No progress was made on the easing of the sanctions during the previous round of talks. Ecuador's President Guillermo Lasso announces a cut in fuel prices following 2 weeks of anti-government protests over soaring food and energy prices.
Por esto, he decidido.
I decided to reduce the price of gasoline and ecopice to 10 cents per gallon and diesel also to 10 cents per gallon.
In a live address, Lasso also said that Ecuadorians who seek dialogue will find an outstretched hand from the government. He warned, however, that those who seek chaos, violence, and terrorism will find the full force of the law. The announcement comes one day after authorities lifted a state of emergency that had been imposed in 6 provinces in the wake of violent protests. Earlier, the country's energy ministry said that crude output is at a critical level and could be halted entirely within 48 hours if protests and roadblocks continued. The demonstrations by largely indigenous groups began on June 13 and have led to at least 6 civilian deaths. The protesters were demanding lower fuel and food prices, among other things. In Ukraine, a rescue operation is underway for the survivors of a Russian missile attack on a shopping mall. According to Ukrainian authorities, at least 18 people have lost their lives and 25 are hospitalized, while about 36 others are still missing. Up to 1,000 people were at the shopping center in the central city of Kremenchuk when the strike happened. President Volodymyr Zelensky says the Monday attack was calculated, while the UN has described it as deplorable. In response, Russia's deputy ambassador to the UN, Dmitry Polyansky, is accusing Kiev of using the incident to gain sympathy ahead of the NATO meeting. He says that for now there are conflicting accounts and that Moscow is waiting for the Defense Ministry's report. In the UK, strikes over low wages have spread to the legal profession. British criminal lawyers have staged a walkout in London to protest against government funding and dwindling earnings. According to the Criminal Bar Association, barristers voted for industrial action earlier this month. More than 80% of its members backed walkouts. On Monday, several hundred barristers gathered outside of the Central Criminal Court. They have refused to take on new cases or cover cases for colleagues, which have overrun. Protesting lawmakers say that their real earnings have dropped around 30% since 2006. They also say that many junior barristers have left their jobs due to low income. The Criminal Bar Association has urged the government to sit down with barristers for negotiations.
This must come to an end, and it will, if this government is prepared to sit down with us and negotiate. We cannot continue to work like this.
The CBA also said the walkout is aimed at preventing the collapse of the criminal justice system, which is already mired in crisis. It said the justice system has long been suffering from a shortage of lawyers. The British government has reacted to the strike, saying the walkouts are regrettable. The lawyers' strike comes hot on the heels of an industrial action by some 40,000 British railway workers. Countries across the world, Europe in particular, are experiencing public outrage over worsening living standards due to high inflation. Several European states are witnessing protests, with strikes in Belgium and the UK causing the cancellation of dozens of flights. Britain's railway system is also coming to a standstill.
Strikes in Europe's transport sector have disrupted air flights and train schedules as transportation companies struggle to cope with rising demand at the start of the peak of summer travel season after COVID restrictions were lifted. A strike by staff members at Irish Airline, Ryanair, and Brussels Airlines over pay and working conditions forced the cancellation of many flights. The workers' strike also disrupted flight schedules in Spain, Italy, France, Portugal, and Belgium. Meanwhile, earlier this week, the British railway system once again came to a halt. Tens of thousands of workers have walked in Britain's biggest rail strike in 30 years, with millions of passengers facing days of chaos as both the unions and the government have stuck to their guns in a row over pay. The British Transport Union, the National Union of Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers, RMT, threatened to continue the industrial action until managers address the workers' grievances and meet their salary demands. According to the UK government career service, RMT members who are not high earners, for example train guards and track maintenance staff, earn somewhere between £20,000 to £35,000. But the union says its members deserve more. Despite the ongoing negotiations between representatives from the management and staff, the media predicted the strikes to continue. They attributed further industrial action to the rapidly rising inflation rates exacerbated by sluggish economic growth, saying this combo will likely lead to more worker strikes across the European continent in the summer ahead.
The people who are on strike have been pretty clear about it, including in Great Britain with the railroads, the airline pilots, and everybody else. For some years, they've been in trouble and there have been increasing social unrest. And what's happening now is a huge increase in inflation and hence a decrease in purchasing power, and people's standard of living is going down. And so you're having a confluence of events. You have this economic crisis, then you have this people saying, listen, we cannot let the war in Ukraine completely derail the environmental crisis. And furthermore, the policies, as another group saying, look, the policies that we're pursuing, that our governments are pursuing in Ukraine, are adding to the problem, not making it better.
Unions have said the rail strikes could mark the start of a summer of discontent, with teachers, medics, and even waste disposal workers heading for industrial action as inflation pushes 10%. Inflation has soared across Europe on the back of a major rise in energy costs, and Britain is not alone in facing strikes.
And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A major benefit brought by Imam Khomeini was familiarizing people with the concept of resistance. This is the part of the speech delivered on June 4th, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. On the 33rd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini, greetings be upon him. Imam brought the people to the arena, showed them the way, kept them in the arena and steered them away from despair and hopelessness. During the sacred defense era, he did so in one way and during the coup launched by the Americans at the airbase in Hamadan, he did it in another way. It would not be bad for me to recount this memory. After I was informed of a coup by conscientious, pious and young pilots in the Air Force, I notified different organizations and they got ready. The late Mr. Hashemi and I went to Imam because we were worried that Imam might be in danger. We suggested that he leaves his house in Jamaran. He did not accept it, saying that he would not leave. I will stay here, but you should go and protect such and such a place. He mentioned a certain place, which I do not want to mention, and asked us to go and protect it. He would show the arena fighting like this. The same is true of this action at that time, at the time of the sacred defense era. This way was confronting Saddam and his behavior during accepting the resolution.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
If you look at Imam's manifesto for accepting the resolution, you notice that Imam had determined what the people had to do after accepting the resolution. He had explained to the people what the arena of fighting would be after his demise. Imam's testament, statements, and important manifestos in the last year of Imam's life, may God bestow paradise on him, were all efforts to show the arena of fighting to the people after his own time. Well, leading the revolution means this. Leading the revolution is a really significant and meaningful term regarding our magnanimous Imam. In studying the personality of that great leader, we can examine his personal traits and his school of thought. Of course, these require long and detailed discussions. I'll try to briefly raise certain points in this regard. As for his personal traits, a magnanimous Imam was an exemplary personality in the true sense of the word. He was really exemplary. His personal characteristics were such that few personalities could have all together.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. You've done
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Now, the UN Human Rights Office agrees that the veteran Palestinian journalist was killed by Israeli fire last month. The probe finds that Abu Akleh and her colleague were targeted by seemingly well-aimed bullets as they covered a military raid in the occupied West Bank.
All the information we have gathered, including official documentation from the Israeli military and the Palestinian Attorney General, is consistent with the finding that the shots that killed Abu Akleh and injured her colleague came from Israeli security forces and not from indiscriminate firing by armed Palestinians, as was initially claimed by the Israeli authorities.
So far, several media organizations have conducted their own investigations into the incident, and all have come to the same conclusion. Multiple witnesses also agreed with the probes, stating that Israeli forces shot the veteran Palestinian reporter. Meanwhile, Al Jazeera and its host country, Qatar, pointed the fingers at Israel from the outset. The UN has also confirmed that Abu Akleh was wearing a blue flak jacket marked with the word press when being shot by Israeli troops, exposing the gruesome nature of the daylight murder and suggesting that they were deliberately targeted.
As long as the United States and its allies continue to not only embrace this position, but to promote this position using every tactic at their disposal, including threats, the more that has been the case, the more the occupation is quite happy to resort to war crimes bordering on what one could also say are crimes against humanity, albeit in a very calculated move, drawn out over a period of decades, as is the case with ethnic cleansing, which if it happened over a shorter period of time, would fit very nicely with the definition of a genocide.
The killing of yet another journalist is, however, in line with the pattern of Israeli violence against reporters and other members of the media. The Palestinian Ministry of Information says at least 45 journalists have been killed by Israeli forces since 2000. Israeli brutality against Palestinians and journalists has been a topic of discussion for many years now. The regime has, however, never accepted blame for its wrongdoing, and in nearly all cases baselessly shifted the blame on Palestinians, and the case of Abu Akleh is no exception. Following the UN's report, the Israeli regime insisted that the fatal shooting of Abu Akleh was unintentional, pointing out at the same time that it had not received access to critical evidence that might determine whether she was killed by an Israeli soldier or a Palestinian gunman. Israel's military also says Palestinian authorities should hand over the bullet that killed Shireen. The demand has, however, been met by widespread criticism, with Palestinians saying the regime should hand over the gun, which is believed to have killed the journalist, as Israel can't be trusted of conducting a fair investigation of itself. The murder of Abu Akleh, which sparked global outrage, only adds to Israel's long list of atrocities against Palestinians. But that fury has yet to translate into any concrete measure, particularly by international bodies such as the UN Security Council. So far, several international organizations have provided evidence of Israel's brutality against Palestinians. UN resolutions have also been passed against Israel for its occupation and blockades of the coastal enclave. Yet, no one, including the UNSC, has used any of its tools to ensure resolutions related to ending the Israeli siege imposed on Gaza have been implemented.
The complete lack of accountability only encourages, as we have seen, more war crimes by the occupation. and the unfortunate that the position long taken by the number one sponsor of the occupation, the United States of America, is that Palestinians and Israelis should resolve their differences through negotiation, and in both instances should be prevented from invoking international law and the institutions which administer it in order to impose a solution in keeping with their respective legal obligations in this so-called rules-based international order. And that, of course, is really quite absurd.
Instead, many of the UNSC member states have doubled their support for Israel, despite its blockade and bombardment of Gaza and murdering dozens of innocent women and children. Some even increased their support for the regime and obliged neighboring countries to forge ties with it. And in absence of action, there is no reason to expect Israeli violence against the Palestinians, whether a journalist or not, whether well-known or not, will end anytime soon.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says the European Union and NATO are gathering a coalition for war with Moscow. This after the EU unanimously granted candidacy status to Ukraine and Moldova. Lavrov drew parallels between current-day events and those of the first half of the 20th century when Germany was preparing an attack on the Soviet Union.
When the Second World War was about to start, Hitler gathered most of the European countries under his banners. Now the EU and NATO are also gathering the same modern coalition for the fight, and by and large for war with the Russian Federation. We will look at this very carefully.
Lavrov's remarks came after the EU leaders stepped up rhetoric against Russia.
EU's decision strengthens Ukraine and Moldova in the face of Russian aggression.
A confrontation between Moscow and NATO's nuclear-armed members would have catastrophic consequences for Europe. After all, Europe would be the immediate theater of such a war.
In terms of the possibilities of war, NATO fighting a war with Russia, I don't think they are very good. First of all, because the United States will not suffer as a result of this war. The Europeans will suffer. The Europeans, if they start down this path, they will unleash a nuclear war, in which case their entire, all of the NATO countries will be destroyed, all of the NATO bases. It will be a catastrophe for these people. And I think the leaders of the three major countries, Germany, France, and Italy, I think they understand this. And I think that's why they have been going to Kiev to have discussions with President Zelensky. They know that the people, this is not in their interest.
Candidate status is only the first step on the path to EU membership, which can take decades. But putting the EU action in the context of the current state of affairs, we can see that the rising escalation might quickly lead to catastrophic consequences. Tensions are also increasing between the EU and Russia over the growing Kaliningrad crisis. This after Lithuania began enforcing the EU sanctions and restricted the transit of goods to Kaliningrad. Moscow says the move amounts to a blockade of its exclave and has warned of serious consequences.
As for retaliatory measures and what they will be like, will they be exclusively in the diplomatic dimension? The answer is no. They will not be in the diplomatic dimension. They will be practical.
A move by Russia on Lithuania would clearly trigger NATO's Article 5 mutual defense provision, immediately pulling in all the alliance's members to a potential nuclear war with Russia. But how far can the Europeans really push for such an escalatory path with Russia, especially at a time when they are experiencing an energy crisis?
If you're asking me personally, I personally think that the main reason for the war in the Ukraine was to block the alliance between Germany and Russia. And the symbol of that alliance was the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which never got opened. As a result, now Germany is in a critical crisis because Russia has control of its energy. Russia just turned dialed down 40% of its energy. Germany cannot survive under these conditions. It is not in Germany's interest to commit suicide for the United States of America.
On Thursday, Ukraine said it had received U.S. supplies of high-mobility artillery rocket systems, a powerful long-range weapon system that Kiev hopes can help turn the tide on Russia's military offensive. Russian officials have repeatedly warned that the U.S. decision to supply Ukraine with advanced rocket systems could exacerbate the conflict.
Iran has released fresh details about the covert and planned operations of agents of Israeli spy agency in Iran. Officials say the three agents detained back in April were planning to assassinate Iranian nuclear scientists. Officials say the agents were arrested following a complicated intelligence operation that lasted 8 months. Judiciary officials say some members of the cell have been arrested in Iran's southeastern Sistan and Balochistan province, while other members and operatives have been detained outside the province by Iran's intelligence forces. Officials say the case is under preliminary investigation and that an indictment would be filed and sent to court soon. This is not the first time Iran busts Mossad-linked terrorists. In July last year, Iran's intelligence ministry arrested a network of agents with the Israeli Mossad spy agency at the western borders, confiscating a large cache of weapons and ammunition that they were planning to use to provoke riots and terror inside the country.
Well, of course there should be, and I don't think anyone is really going to seriously say it's unthinkable that Israel would try to assassinate Iranian figures, whether in science or politics. They've got a demonstrable propensity to do so, and they boast about it.
The arrests come amid open threats by Israeli officials against Iranian nuclear scientists and facilities. The regime is notorious for its sabotage activities and assassinations in Iran.
And the reason behind its stepped-up hostility toward Iran, and a very open hostility, is that Israel seeks to be the lone superpower, or you could say mini superpower, of the region as a junior partner of the big superpower, the United States.
Israel has tried various ways to stop Iran's nuclear progress. They include acts of sabotage, assassinating Iranian nuclear scientists, as well as threats to bomb Iran's nuclear installations. Probably the most high-profile assassination was the killing of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, a top Iranian nuclear scientist who was brutally murdered by Mossad agents in 2020. Mossad was involved in an explosion that hit Iran's Natanz nuclear facility in 2021. Israel was also the main regional force that pushed the United States to exert economic and diplomatic pressure on Iran. The policy culminated in the so-called maximum pressure campaign of former President Donald Trump, but none of those policies reached their stated goals. Iran's economy did not collapse, and its nuclear program has accelerated massively after the U.S. quit the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, in 2018.
It's the whole establishment, the whole Israeli establishment, that has this extreme hostility toward Iran and wants to continue to take action in the hopes of provoking something greater. It carries out assassinations, there's no question about that. It carries out bombings inside the country, carried out by covert agents. I think right now the United States government is not wishing to see an escalation into a full-blown war. And Israel does, in the final analysis, have to pay attention to what Washington thinks and says.
Just recently, a top U.S. think tank admitted to Israel's failure towards Iran. A report by Atlantic Council said that Israel's policy has failed to stop Iran. The article said the Tel Aviv regime needs to recalculate and adopt a strategy that corresponds to the current state of the Iranian nuclear program. Given the current state of affairs, the United States, which is Israel's staunch ally, needs to reconsider its unilateral support for Israel.
The meeting of leaders of the BRICS group of nations occurs amid major shifts in the geopolitical order. Talks have been held in a virtual format for the third consecutive year. The group owes its name to the initials of its five member states, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, and emerged in 2009. This year, leaders focused on global economy and the changing dynamics of geopolitical and strategic alliances. Russia has already called on the group's members to integrate their payment systems and use their respective national currencies for intra-organizational trade. The call came amid the West's unprecedented anti-Russia sanctions over Moscow's military operation in Ukraine. The coercive economic measures have cut some Russian banks off from the SWIFT interbank messaging and financial system, and tensions with the West. China also sees the summit as a platform to promote its vision for how international relations should be conducted. Chinese President Xi Jinping made a four-point proposal on pursuing high-quality development of BRICS cooperation. Xi stressed that BRICS countries, as important emerging markets and major developing countries, need to act with a sense of responsibility to bring positive, stabilizing, and constructive strength to the world.
But if you look at the Western nations, in particular in the U.S., there's a strong anti-globalization trend. And what the U.S. is doing today is basically create a lot of, mischievous behavior policies to disrupt global supply chain. That creates a lot of problems. So in that sense, I think they do, the grouping have, the nations, they have a lot in common. And it's obviously everybody understands if they can unite with each other and have their voice heard, and they can better defend their interests and better build a more fairer and say a more just international order.
This year's agenda covered a range of topics, but particular emphasis was given to renewing multilateralism for global economic recovery, deepening coordination on climate action, and strengthening coordination on public health.
I think there are probably several issues, several reasons why it's resilient, why it's emerging stronger and stronger as a grouping. And firstly, I think it's, they have something in common. That is, they feel this international system, which was established mostly by Western countries, is not fair, is not just enough for developing countries, for example. We know that is Western countries' dominant international system. When the Western countries talk about, rules-based international order, often those rules are produced in Washington or in Brussels.
The economy has always been at the heart of the BRICS, but the Ukraine war loomed large over the summit. The economic impact of the war and the sanctions on Russia is showing across the world. Inflation is up in many countries, global supply chains have been disrupted, and there are fears of food shortages. Russia and China see the group as potential counterweight against Western-led hegemonic desires and imperialist intentions.
Obviously, now we are seeing the emergency of or emerging of the multilateral world. You have Russia, which basically made it very public that the unilateral world has concluded, and the U.S. should accept that kind of reality, harsh reality for them. And with the rise of China, and we are basically seeing a center, a new center. Before China's emerging power, you can see Washington would say the world center is in Washington, is in the U.S. And now you have a new center in Beijing.
BRICS nations have a combined population of 3.23 billion, and their combined GDP is more than $23 trillion. China proposed expanding the BRICS grouping during a meeting of the bloc's foreign ministers in May. Though the suggestion was welcomed by other member countries, there have been no official announcements of who the new members might be.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم امر الله سبحانه الا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام يوم المظلوم على الظالم أشد من يوم الظالم على المظلوم.
۶
Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam said, "The day of the oppressed over the oppressor will be severer than the day of the oppressor over the oppressed."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio. The program is To My Brother, and we are discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Dear friends, in the beautiful and universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, we find that Imam Ali was not only a wealthy person, but he was also very knowledgeable. Now, what is interesting is that despite the great wealth that Imam Ali alayhi salam had, we always hear about his patched clothes, his worn out and broken sandals, or we see how the situation at home wasn't exactly luxurious when it comes to financial matters. But as we said in the initial part of the program, Imam Ali alayhi salam was actually quite wealthy. The missing piece of this puzzle is that Imam Ali gave away his wealth on the path of Allah for the sake of Allah. And so this is why we find that Imam Ali had patches upon his clothes and he had sandals which were torn. Of course, it is very famous that Imam Ali alayhi salam bought two shirts, and he gave the better of the two shirts to his servant, Qambar, and he himself took the shirt which had less value. With keeping all this in mind, we find that Imam Ali alayhi salam says, "Knowledge is better than wealth, for knowledge guards you, while you have to guard your wealth. And wealth decreases by spending, while knowledge multiplies by spending." Here, dear friends, Imam Ali tells us two ways in which knowledge is much better than wealth. First off, knowledge guards you, protects you, your personality, your persona, who you represent, who you are. Knowledge guards it. But on the other hand, you have to constantly be cautious of your wealth, and you have to constantly guard your wealth, and you have to constantly be worried and preoccupied about your wealth. And the second way in which knowledge is better than wealth, wealth decreases as you spend it. The more you spend it, the faster you spend it, the faster wealth decreases. But knowledge, on the other hand, multiplies by spending. Now, you might ask, how exactly does one spend knowledge? Well, first and foremost, you act upon the knowledge that you have acquired. This is the first kind of spending. And the second kind of spending is that you teach the knowledge that you have acquired to others around you. So again, knowledge is truly better than wealth. A beautiful and comprehensive lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program To My Brother. I'm Atta, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I invite you to listen to the Arabic text of Ziyara Aminullah along with the English translation. Please stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم فاجعل نفسي مطمئنة بقدرك راضية بقضائك.
O Allah, let me be happy and satisfied with that which Thou considers good for me. Let me agree with that which Thou decides for me. Let me passionately remember Thee and invoke Thee. Let me be in love with Thy pure and sincere friends. Let me be well-liked and respected on the earth and in the heavens. Let me be unruffled and well-composed in the midst of misfortunes. Let me be gratefully thankful in prosperity. Let me be mindful of much and more bounties. Let me ardently desire for the heart-warming meeting with Thee, well-equipped with piety to gain my end on the day of requital. Let me follow into the footsteps of Thy representatives. Let me disassociate myself from the mannerism of Thy enemies. Let me pass my time in this world by praising and glorifying Thee.
كل صبح وكل شراب أيام تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاب قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبيب لها ولا رغي
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah. He was born inside the place that billions face in prayer. He was martyred in one of the best places of prayer whilst performing prayer. He gave charity in prayer and was praised by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The commander of the faithful, Imam Ali alayhi salam, loved his salah. How can he not, when he was the closest human being and the best student of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wasallam? How best then to honor the man born inside the Kaaba and martyred in Masjid al-Kufa, who dedicated his life for Tawheed and the oneness of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, than to learn from his prayers? Here are lessons that we can learn from the salah of the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali alayhi salam. Number 4, the physical respect. If a human being is in their salah, their body, clothes, and everything around them will be glorifying God. Imam Ali alayhi salam is reported to have said, that means what we wear in prayer should be suitable, clean, as well as our body should be nicely fragranced. Number 5, seeking that awe of Allah. Sometimes people are distracted during salah by what's around them, or their own bodies, or in fact, their clothes. Indeed, Imam Ali alayhi salam is reported to have said, don't play with your beard or anything else that